This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, searching for dinosaurs. Paleontologist Michael Novacek joins us to talk about looking for ancient animals. When Michael Novacek was a boy growing up in Los Angeles, he dreamed of expeditions, was intrigued by the holdings of the city's Natural History Museum, and marveled at the wonder of the Grand Canyon. Novacek writes about how he came to paleontology and offers readers a natural history of the Earth in his new book, Time Traveler, In Search of Dinosaurs and Ancient Mammals from Montana to Mongolia. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Michael Novacek is curator of paleontology, senior vice president, and provost of science at the American Museum of Natural History. He's the author of many articles and a number of books, including Dinosaurs of the Flaming Cliffs. His latest book, Time Traveler, is published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Michael Novacek, good afternoon. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
Nice to talk with you.
Yes.
Now, lots of kids get very excited about dinosaurs and fossils and rocks, but they don't become paleontologists. Now, your path to paleontology was not without some twists and turns, but, what led you away from your boyhood interest, then back to it?
Well, it's the usual stuff, I think. I mean, I started as a dinosaur fiend. I mean, just crazy about dinosaurs, but I was fairly crazy about science, even chemistry and astronomy and a variety of other things. And then I became a teenager in Los Angeles, and I don't think there was any competition there from the scholastic or the world of science or anything else. I just basically went into a trance and started soaking up the Southern California experience, as my parents will remind me often. I was certainly at the beach a lot, and I started playing music and everything else, and I just got engulfed by SoCal culture, Southern California culture, as we say. So what got me back into it? Well, a teacher, I started, it was a somewhat ambivalence. I started college, and I was working at UCLA, and I just ran into this incredible teacher who, by coincidence, happened to be a paleontologist. And I think the most important words ever professionally stated in terms of my own life were his in the form of a question when he said, "Well, would you like to go in the field on an expedition?" And I think essentially that changed my life, certainly my career, and the way my experiences since that time.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about this man, Dr. Peter Vaughan.
Well, Peter was an interesting guy. He is an interesting guy. He lives in a beautiful desert area outside of Phoenix. In school, he was rather formidable. I mean, he was a recent PhD graduate, young professor from Harvard, and he could lecture like crazy. He was just a perfect lecturer, but his class was very challenging. And I was a bit intimidated by him, but he had a sort of a dual personality, because when he got out to the field, he started to transform himself into, the field explorer, and it came very friendly, casual, relaxed. So the same guy who we'd have to rush to take notes from in class could sit over and lean against a ranch friend at a fence and talk to a rancher for an hour, with a blade of grass between his teeth. So it's the same guy, but a completely different persona once we get out in the field.
It also seems that he has kind of a sixth sense about a place.
Well, this was what struck me. when I was out there, of course, I didn't know anything. I had some experiences as a boy collecting fossils, but I didn't really know much about collecting. How could this guy just essentially magically pull bone from the rock? I couldn't see it. And he had a real sense of where that bone was, and he had, of course, he had a lot of experience, and he knew where to look. And that's something it takes some time to learn, as I found out. Mm. But I was mystified first field season and somewhat frustrated with his success and my failure.
Mm. He would tell you paleontological, that's a hard word to say, isn't
yeah.
it? Field work.
Fossil hunting.
Let me just say field work
yeah.
is 49% anticipation, 49% recollection, and 2% success.
Right.
What does he mean by the recollection part of that equation?
Well, I think it's funny, you know, you come back from a field season, and first of all, the year before you're leaving for the field, and we certainly feel this way going to Mongolia or any far-flung place, you're just talking about it. You know, well, it's going to be fun, we're going to do this, we're going to look here. So there's all this excitement. And then when you come back, of course, then everybody is regaled with all your stories about mm-hmm. your experiences that summer. And so there's a certain resonance to the field experience that extends far beyond the 6 or 7 weeks you might be out there. And I think that's – and then those stories start to accumulate, and whether how far they deviate from facts is another matter, but they do become somewhat like legends. And then sometimes some of those field seasons tend to merge into others and so forth. One thing I was so concerned about that to some degree that one thing I learned to do early was to take a lot of field notes. And a lot of my book really comes from those, and they're not really written out in a prose form, really comes from those field notes that extend pretty far back into the past.
Mm. And being familiar with a site is also very, very important. You want to know it really intimately.
Yeah, it's very important. It's a person who's worked a site for many years really can derive a lot more from it than even the most experienced professional comes your way, because they're familiar with every nook and cranny of the area.
Would you walk us through the early going in the field? How do you approach a site?
Well, there are different ways. The first part of field work, and in fact, a good part of that experience, is a lot of wandering around, especially if you're in a new major region in the world where there hasn't been much collecting. In many ways, this is the hardest part because you don't have that many clues. You might have a very large area to navigate, but you don't really have the clues that'll let you focus in. So you bring your maps, and if you have them, your aerial photos or your satellite images, and you do a lot of driving. You look through binoculars at a cliff in the distance and decide whether you're going to go over there. Once you decide that you've found a fairly decent spot or attractive-looking spot, you get out, either alone or with your crew, and just start walking and look at the ground. And you walk and walk and look and walk and walk. And bonus on the surface, you know. You don't go digging. You don't say, well, this looks like a likely spot. Let's dig here. You really have to prospect before you do anything. Mm-hmm. Quarrying or excavating fossils only occurs when it looks like it's going to be worthwhile doing all that work. You see bits of a skeleton weathering out or a skull or something, and you say, aha, let's go for it. You know? So it's really a large part of this is prospecting, walking, and looking.
Hmm. You began working in Mongolia in the Gobi in 1990, and then in 1993 you found a remarkable site. How was that site discovered?
Well, it is a strange sort of coincidence and hunch. This was a small spot. Wasn't very dramatic by Gobi standards. It was a lot less exposed than some of the, a lot less spectacular than some of the canyon lands to the western part of the desert. And we actually passed the site 3 years in a row because we weren't interested in, just didn't look dramatic enough. Then on the fourth year, we decided, let's just drive near there. We were actually aiming for an outcrop that looked a lot better than these low hills. But we got our tanker. We carried all our gas with us in the Gobi. We got our gas tanker stuck in the sand. It was always getting stuck. And I said, well, let's make camp here. And in the morning, we have to wait here anyway while the drivers dig the tanker out. Let's just drive over to those low hills and look around. And then we'll leave by noon. So we drove over there, and within about an hour, we essentially knew we had found the richest site in the Gobi Desert. And perhaps by lunchtime, we figured that we just about had the richest dinosaur site in the world in terms of the exquisite and plentiful number of skeletons.
Mm. So many exciting finds have been made there. Is there any one that really stands out, or they all seem so breathtaking?
Well, that first day was pretty hard to beat. Yeah. You know, we found a dinosaur embryo, the first embryo of a meat-eating dinosaur. There were actually two very small. There was actually not only an embryo and an egg, but a very small dinosaur in the nest of a different kind, which was quite remarkable, extraordinary, really. And later that same day, we found an oviraptor, an adult oviraptor with a long claws, this very strange beak-faced dinosaur. We didn't know it until excavating it for several days that it was actually sitting on a huge tier of eggs. So we got a nesting dinosaur and a dinosaur embryo all in one day. Mm-hmm. Of course, since then, we've found many, many more dinosaur skeletons, and several of them are actually nesting dinosaurs.
Mm. What's that eureka moment like? And you know, how do you go to sleep that night?
It didn't seem real, I guess. We were very happy. Of course, I just felt a little weird. There was a little bit of, in the afternoon, a little bit of wistfulness, because you knew you had worked for 20 years in the field and you never had a day like that. You figured you might never have a day like that again.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of said, well, this is what it's really like. And you kind of shake. I was shaking a little bit. I was pretty excited. We were all, and we kept looking at each other and saying, wow, is this really happening to us? And you know that funny feeling you have when you wake up in the morning and you don't know where you are?
Mm-hmm.
In the morning, I woke up and I knew where I was, but I didn't think I had done what I had done the day before. And then I looked around and I could see the plaster jackets encasing some of the dinosaur bones and these big containers full of all these fabulous fossils we had found in one day. And I realized, yep, we actually did that.
Hmm. You mentioned, you know, the eggs and the dinosaur sitting on the eggs. Have you learned anything new about how these creatures behaved?
It's hard to reconstruct the behavior of animals that have been dead for 80 million years,
mm-hmm.
but these specimens come about as close as you could ever imagine to giving us some remarkable insight on dinosaur behavior. For one thing, these oviraptorids are perched on the nest very much like birds. They clearly look like they're protecting the eggs. And the eggs are arranged in a very particular way. They are very methodically arranged in these three tiers of about 20 eggs. We have now several nests that show the same pattern. So it is a very bird-like behavior that we can see, that's fairly clearly suggested by these fossils and the way they're preserved.
Hmm. What can you say at this point about what the landscape might have been like 80 million years ago there?
We know a fair amount from what we've done there, and also I think what some of our predecessors have done. The terrain is remarkable in the sense that in those times, 80 million years ago, this was actually a desert. Most dinosaur sites are not in desert environments, do not represent past desert environments. They are actually much wetter environments, floodplains and lakes and rivers, channels. But this was actually a desert. There was a lot of sand, not a lot of vegetation for much of the area. And these dinosaurs were found in probably concentrations where there was a little water. So what we think we're getting are these small oases where large numbers of dinosaurs, mammals, and other vertebrates congregate, and where they were, where they died and where they were buried.
You go back next month?
Oh, yes, yes.
And what's on the agenda this summer?
Well, there's going to be a lot of prospecting of the eastern Gobi, an area where we haven't been before. And we will probably be doing also some work, if possible, in the very far western reaches of the desert as well. And so we may spend very limited time at this rich site that we found in 1993.
What's life like out there in the desert? How long a period of time are you out there?
It's about 6 weeks. It's a great life. It's a lot of fun. It's very casual. It's not to the taste of many people. But I love being out there. It's a beautiful place, very open. The climate can be tough, but the nights are cool. I like to sleep on the ground. We bring our own food and camping gear and our trucks, and we're sort of a self-contained community. It varies between about 18 and 25. I guess we've had as many as 35 people on some years. So we're like a little town.
Yeah.
In fact, in some parts of that desert, in the Gobi, we're the largest town in the area. It's a great life. And, you know, to sleep under the stars and all that, I guess I'd say. But and there's a good community of friends and people that work hard together.
Yeah. Is it difficult to re-enter New York City after?
It sure is.
Weeks?
It's so funny, though, because the trip's so exhausting, really, any of these expeditions, and not just the work in the field, but the logistics and the agreements and getting things through customs and shipping and all that. When I get back here, I don't want to go back for 10 years. But as the months go on, you get a hankering for getting back out there.
Feeling that 49% anticipation.
That's right.
Yeah. Do sites change much over the time you visit them? You've been working now there in the Gobi for a dozen years.
Yeah, they do change, because if you're really successful at collecting and working them, the bone starts to give out a little bit. It starts to, you're not going to strike it as rich as you did in the early phases. There's never anything like finding a locality for the first time, being the group or the team that actually finds that locality. That's a remarkable experience. But, you know, as the years go on, the bone starts to diminish, or it gets harder to find the good specimens. And we've experienced that even in this site in the Gobi. But it's still worth visiting every year, because it's rich enough to produce something really good, or more than one thing, a lot of very nice specimens.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're working on something that goes back 80 million years, and yet I sense from what you just said, you feel a certain pressure to get in there and do all the work you can.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. Unfortunately, some sites have been plundered by people who haven't really cared to take the scientific information. There's quite a bit of commercial activity now in fossils, because their value on the market has gone way up. So we're trying to protect a lot of these sites from from unmanaged collection. So we're anxious, and that's difficult to do, and so we're anxious to try to retrieve as much as we can from these sites. And when we have an opportunity to very accurately collect information and data on how we found them and where we found them and in what rocks we found them and so forth.
Mm. Paleontologist Michael Novacek is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Time Traveler in Search of Dinosaurs and Ancient Mammals from Montana to Mongolia. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. The telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Someone's waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line. A listener in Indiana. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hi.
I remember reading Roy Chapman Andrews 70 years ago or more about his work there, and I suppose you'd have read him too. And I just wonder why he went there to begin with.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Andrews was, of course, the person, his team from this museum, from the American Museum of Natural History, who went out to the Gobi Desert and found the Flaming Cliffs and the first dinosaur eggs, not embryos, but eggs. And, of course, this was a very, very famous discovery. It was made in 1922 and 1923. And he didn't go out there for that purpose. He had convinced the museum administrators that this was possibly the source for ancient humans. And at the time, there was a scientific theory that suggested that humans came from Asia and not from Africa. And he was influenced by that and got the president of the museum interested in that, excited about it. And he launched a very expensive expedition in the 1920s to do this. Now, Andrews had spent a lot of time in China and Japan doing actually zoological, biological surveys, and he was a real Asiaphile. He loved the Far East, so he really wanted to spend more time there, and this, he figured, was the way to do it.
So he changed his study to dinosaurs from human beings then?
He certainly did when he found them. Now, he himself didn't describe many of these animals. He was more of a zoologist than a paleontologist, but he had a crack team of world expert, top leading paleontologists from the American Museum, including Walter Granger, who was a member of the expedition.
Well, his books were a good read 70 years ago. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Zoology, geology, paleontology, all these fields come together in the kind of work that you do. Are there zoologists and geologists on your expeditions?
Yes, actually there are. Geology is a very important part of it, and we have to take very specialized people for some of the detailed studies of the rock units and for age dating rocks and so forth. We have to take a very specialized team of geologists with us to do that work. So, and we've had zoologists out there, too, just because we've gone into such remote areas where certain things are very poorly known, like the insects. We had a person out there collecting insects with us for a few summers because a lot of these insects are they're living species, but they're new species, completely new to science.
You know, when I think of this work, I think, you know, the dinosaurs are, you know, the glamorous stars of the show, but there's also so many other interesting things out there to study.
It's true. And, you know, from my standpoint, many scientists' standpoint, dinosaurs aren't that interesting. They're not as interesting as the mammals, for example, because we're just learning, beginning to learn some very exciting things about the early evolution of mammals. And some of the best clues to that come from study of fossils in the Gobi Desert. 80 million years old, where we have these beautiful fossils, skeletons, with virtually nothing that old elsewhere in the world has produced such skeletons. And so they're very important to talking about our own ancestry.
Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line one. Hello there. Do we have a caller there on line one? Apparently not. Maybe they will call us back if they would like to talk with us. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. A little while ago, you mentioned satellite images being important in your work. In the book, you mentioned the CAT scan as a technology that's been a boon.
Right.
How is technology changing the work in the field and in the lab?
A lot. There are still some traditional operations that haven't changed. You still have to find fossils, and that takes walking and looking and digging. You have to prepare fossils, and the people who really know how to remove the rock and glue the skeletons back together, they developed a rare and highly refined skills that are most needed. And so, and that's a tradition that's carried on for more than a century. But the new techniques really help. Imaging techniques, not only the CAT scans, but the 3D computer imaging that we can do from those CAT scanned images are just fantastic for research. We can put them on the web. We can transfer that information to colleagues. Indeed, we're trying now to collect many images from fossils and other creatures and develop a huge interactive web-based system so people can actually do research together electronically. And of course, satellite images are very helpful for as prospecting tools, for mapping, just for getting unlost and other things. That GPS, just the global positioning system, really was just coming into use in the early 90s when we started our Gobi expeditions. And since we got lost a lot, they were very handy.
Reading your book, I found myself thinking a lot about the enormity of time. You know, the Earth is, I now know today anyway, I don't know how long it will stick with me, but the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. You know, but we're living in the fast line, and I think it's, for me, it's very hard to reflect on the meaning of a million years or a billion and more. How do you find yourself thinking about that issue?
That's a good question, Celeste. I think about it only occasionally. It's funny, when I'm collecting, everything seems so immediate to me. I don't say, "Wow, this is 80 million years old." It's almost because the clues we go on, we can go on very fragmentary clues and know where we are. You know something about the kinds of animals that live there and even their age. So that has a sort of immediacy to it. But when I sit back and think about it, then I think this is kind of crazy. I mean, what are we doing here? We're fairly vividly reconstructing an Earth that existed beyond in some incomprehensibly distance from us in time. And it just seems very odd that we're able to do that at all.
Five great extinctions.
Yeah.
What qualifies as a great extinction?
I think a certain percentage of decimation, because extinction's going on all the time in the record, and other species are replacing ones that have disappeared. But every once in a while, at least five times, there seems to be a major event where such a large part of the biota on Earth gets wiped out that it takes some while for it to recover, and you get a whole range of different kinds of animals and plants and other organisms that are part of that recovery phase. So we're talking about events that wiped anywhere, you know, wiped out 60 to 70%, and in one case, 95%, as far as our best estimates go, of all the species that lived on the planet. Imagine the scope of that and the intensity of that kind of decimation.
Yeah, but then slowly, very slowly, life came back.
Yeah, that's true.
Not roaring back, but...
Yeah, not roaring back. Not in most cases. In fact, there's been estimates suggested that it took about 10 million years on average for diversity to come back to its, you know, the different kinds of species, even if they were different new animals, but just the pure raw diversity to come back after an extinction event.
Wow. In our time, we're seeing extinctions. How do they compare with the great extinctions over time?
Unfortunately, they compare impressively. At least
really?
A lot of us think so. The rate of habitat destruction on the surface of the Earth and the reduction of wild areas is such that it's highly plausible that we're losing thousands of species a year, and that perhaps even by the middle of the century, we may lose anywhere from 30 to 50% of all the species that exist on the Earth. That's a pretty serious statistic. Now, we might come back. I mean, just like these ancient extinction events, the biota might come back. But we probably, as humans, don't want to wait for 10 million years for that to do so.
I don't have that kind of time. Michael Novacek is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Michael Novacek is curator of paleontology, senior vice president and provost of science at the American Museum of Natural History. His new book is Time Traveler in Search of Dinosaurs and Ancient Mammals from Montana to Mongolia. Listeners, your questions are invited. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go back to your childhood. I think it was a pretty interesting part of the book. It's a pleasure to read this book because it's not only is there a lot of meat in it in terms of science. There's also a lot of personal stuff in the book.
Yeah, thanks.
That's charming to read. You're one of four boys.
Right.
Did your brother share your enthusiasm for dinosaurs and fossils?
Actually, when I think about it, no. Most of them had other interests. Actually, we're all interested in music, and two of the other brothers are professional musicians. One's an architect. I think I was the science guy in the group. So we had shared common interests in outdoors and the beach and music and other things, but not so much on the science front.
Yeah. Although your mom is a scientist.
She certainly is. I mean, she could have been a great professional scientist if she had taken that pathway or if the opportunities were so immediate for her. But she obviously has a naturalist eye and intellectual interest and commitment to science and many other things. And so she was an inspiration to me, there's no question.
Yeah. How often did the family set off for the Grand Canyon when you were kids?
Well, we couldn't do it that much, but my parents loved the outdoors and they loved to take us camping. And so when we got the opportunity, we did it. My dad was a musician, and he had travel a lot. And as I mentioned in the book, we used to take that drive across the desert, which he knew so well because he had to play in Las Vegas, quite a bit with his jazz trio. So, you know, they like to drive, and they like to wander around the beauty of the American West. And so any time we had an opportunity, we went out there.
Hmm. And you fantasized about living in the canyon.
Yeah. You seem like a good place. I had a real intense obsession with the canyon. I guess it was, I did, as I said in the book, have a, it allowed me to associate time and large-scale things with something real. Although, you know, you may have experienced this yourself if you've ever been to the canyon. When you look at it, it doesn't look real.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard to take in. I mean, and there it is, tangibly before you. But it's just so huge and so weird and so intricately carved that it doesn't look real. It's almost like some kind of diorama beyond a piece of glass.
Yeah. I haven't been on the ground there, but I've flown over it.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time seeing it and just thinking, oh, can we go back over over that? It is. It's truly, truly amazing.
Yeah.
And it's a very old place. The rocks there are very old, but not the oldest.
No, they're not the oldest, and there are much older rocks in Greenland and Australia and other places. And interestingly enough, it although it's old enough, so it doesn't have, it doesn't really preserve the last 200 million years or so of time either. So there are no rocks in there in that canyon exposed that are young enough to have dinosaurs in them.
Mm.
And a lot of people are surprised to find that out. Mm-hmm. That those rocks are so ancient that they don't even encompass the age of the dinosaurs.
Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line again, a caller in Charleston. Hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I have a question regarding the most recent extinction, 60-odd million years ago, of dinosaurs. I guess it was quite controversial starting back a few dozen years ago or so about the notion of an extinction of the dinosaurs occurring from as a result of a meteor impact. As a geology student, we didn't get into that very much years ago. But I had a question that apparently there's others who say that, hey, dinosaurs were kind of on their way out due to perhaps climatic changes or whatever, and that this was kind of the icing on the cake that caused them to become extinct, although their species had been in decline. Is that square with your research?
Well, it's interesting. I think the asteroid, first of all, I think the fact that this asteroid smashed into the Earth very close to the 65-million-year date, if not dead on it, it shouldn't be ignored. Asteroids can, something that big could have really messed things up. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it may have had some environmental impact on the biota, it seems not totally far-fetched to me. What to me the mystery of the extinction event in the Cretaceous is its selectivity. Why did so many groups survive?
Yeah.
Major groups survive with an asteroid impact. Because an asteroid seems to be, if you tie in these different possible outcomes of an asteroid impact, it seems to be something that would promote global climate change and be far less selective in the kinds of animals and so forth that were affected by the event. But a lot of things make it through. You know, dinosaurs, only one group of dinosaurs, the birds, survived, but crocodiles and turtles and a lot of mammal groups and so forth on land, made it right through. And a very similar pattern you see in the marine records. Why did some groups make it and some not? Seems that's a mystery to me.
So it's a continuing source of research, then, I take it.
Oh, absolutely. One of the most interesting thing about this Cretaceous extinction event, this dinosaur extinction event, is just getting better data for what happened, what went extinct in different parts of the world. We only have one place in the world where the record of land vertebrates is good enough to straddle that extinction event preserved in the rock, and that's in Western North America. But we don't have that continuous sequence of rocks with fossils in places like Asia, not yet, Asia and South America and Europe. and we're desperately looking for them because we like to compare that pattern of extinction and replacement in North America, where we have it well documented, to other places in the world.
You mentioned earlier about, I think it was the Permian extinction, where 95% of life was species were destroyed. Could you kind of compare and contrast what you know about those two?
Yeah, the general figure for the dinosaur extinction event or the Cretaceous extinction event is about 70% compared to the 95% in the Permian and Triassic extinction event. Now, how reliable are those figures? I can't tell you. I mean, there's been some argument about what really is being collected there. But I think that, you know, in a rough sense, that gives you that kind of comparison in terms of magnitude and intensity is probably okay. You know, it's probably fairly credible. So you could just say, I guess, that the Permian event was worse.
Was it a bigger asteroid
bigger
or something?
Bang.
Was it a bigger asteroid that hit, or what?
The caller wanted to know if it was a bigger asteroid or a bigger.
We don't know. We're not confident that we have as clear evidence for an asteroid impact for the Permian event. Now, some people have claimed to have found a major asteroid impact site in Western Australia, and there have been other candidates proposed. But, you know, asteroids, we have a record of a lot of meteor impacts through Earth's history. And so aligning these, I would say that right now we don't have the kind of thing we see for the Cretaceous. We don't have as marked an asteroid event associated with the extinction in the Permian.
One last quick question, if I might. Regarding Tyrannosaurus rex, I remember as a youngster seeing the skeleton at the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, being quite impressed with that. I understand there's been some talk about, hey, these guys really weren't as fast and as predatory carnivores as earlier been led to believe. What's your take on that?
Well, actually, I think there are two dimensions to this. One is there's been a theory that these things were actually more scavengers than carnivores or predators, and two that they were not as fast as shown in Jurassic Park or something like that. And actually, I think the more recent paper on their speed, the fact that they're slower in locomotion, is a fairly in-depth analysis. You know, you'll never know for sure, but it's a fairly sophisticated reconstruction of their behavior based on modeling and so forth. That was published a few months ago. The notion that they're scavengers rather than predators, I've never, frankly, really been excited about. There are lots of things like Komodo dragons that don't have to run very fast to be predators. Mm-hmm. They just have to hide in the bushes and jump out. Now, maybe a Tyrannosaurus is pretty hard to hide in a bush, but, I mean, one leap and that giant head with all those teeth, I think, could be pretty effective on a prey item.
Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about their senses and how they experience the world in terms of, you mentioned the Komodo dragon, and I saw an interesting show not long ago on that animal where their power of smell, that sense of smell, is really critical.
Oh, sure. These animals, you know, we don't know directly, but sometimes from the infillings of the skull, almost have a reverse, like a negative image of the brain. We call that an endocast. We can see whether various lobes of the brain are well-developed. And a lot of these animals have well-developed olfactory lobes, which are the smelling centers of the brain. So we would suspect, like many living animals, that these things had very keen sense of smell. From the size of the eye sockets and the orbits, they're probably were fairly keen in their sight. And, of course, based on their relationship with birds, one would suggest that many dinosaurs probably had very acute vision because living order to have that.
Hmm. We've got to wrap up, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say. So nice talking with you.
Nice to talk to you, too.
Before we go, though, I want to ask you this question, because I kind of sense that somebody might be out there listening and thinking, boy, I'd like to be a paleontologist. When someone considering that career asks you for your advice, what do you tell him or her?
Well, depends on their age to some degree. I'm not trying to be discriminate against age in one level or another, but I know that, for instance, if they're a kid, the thing I say to them is, if you really want to do this, keep doing it. Don't lose your interest. Don't get diverted. Because I know that from that my own experience that it's easy to get distracted. If people are older, very often people find themselves adults and they say, "Gee, I don't want to be a lawyer anymore. I want to work on dinosaurs. So what do I do?" I generally, encourage them to get back to school and start taking the kind of courses and the kind of work that prepares them for a field in paleontology. You have to love it. It's not an easy career. There aren't many jobs, and so you've got to have more than anything else perseverance, and not feel frustrated or defeated if you don't get that job or you don't get that paper published or that grant. You have to keep trying. And, if you love it, you will. Mm-hmm. You'll do it. So it's an attractive field. A lot of people want to go into it now because it's become more romantic and more visible to the media and so forth. But it's not an easy career to just decide you want to do that. It takes some sacrifices, and you got to make sure you really love it to do it.
Mm. Thank you again for talking with us this afternoon. Michael Novacek has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His new book, Time Traveler in Search of Dinosaurs and Ancient Animals from Montana to Mongolia, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.